I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for joining us for the Takeaways Weekly Politics Show. And this week, there's only one political show in D.C.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that they will. But today I am still just a bill.
Yes, it's reconciliation deadline week again. And like Modest Little Bill of Schoolhouse Rock fame, President Biden's big $3.5 trillion Billapalooza, the Build Back Better plan, is sitting on Capitol Hill, hoping and praying to be a law someday. But before it's ready for final presidential action, Build Back Better is going through an extreme makeover, Congress edition. It's dropped more than $1 trillion in weight and had a radical facelift. When President Biden reintroduced the plan back in August, he'd hoped to include new ways to cut the price of prescription medication.
By finally giving Medicare the power to negotiate the price of the drug they purchased for the American people.
The president was all in on 2 years of free community college.
That will save them $2,400 a year. That's like a $2,400 tax credit.
And he was ready to raise corporate taxes to pay for it.
Having the largest corporations, including the 55 corporations that paid zero federal tax last year, and the super wealthy, began to pay their fair share.
Recent reports indicate that free community college and the congressional power to negotiate drug prices are out. The expanded child tax credit may be only extended by 1 year, and investments in clean energy are gone. And the plans to raise the corporate tax rate? That's a non-starter. So how did lawmakers decide what remained and what was cut? We thought it might help to ask someone on the inside about this, especially someone who is not seeking re-election. North Carolina's longest-serving Democratic Congressman David Price has held his Durham area seat in nearly every Congress since 1987, and he announced this week that he will not seek an 18th term in office. Congressman Price, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So I want to talk about the reconciliation package. It's lost about £1 trillion from 3.5 down to about 1.9. What's in and what's out right now?
Well, I'm not, you may have overstressed my insider status. I don't want to oversell what I know or what I even could predict, but I have been involved in this, especially in the areas of concern that I preside over on the Appropriations Committee, namely housing and transportation. And I have strong interests otherwise. So I can tell you what I know. I think the first thing to do, though, is to put this in perspective. I mean, this isn't just a matter of what the top line may end up being. We have already passed the relief bill, almost $2 trillion, which is a final installment, or probably is the last we'll do, of major pandemic-related legislation. And, you know, in most Congresses, that would count as an achievement or a kind of conclusive achievement in and of itself. So, so we do have the relief bill, and we also have waiting in the wings the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which involves not just roads and bridges and railroads, but it also involves broadband and the electric grid and water and sewer systems and a lot of other things. So that's going to be an achievement in the trillions. And now we're talking about the very important human infrastructure bill, the so-called reconciliation bill. And the reason we call it that, as you know, is that we have to use this arcane budget procedure known as reconciliation because the Republicans won't offer any help. We have to get around the filibuster, and we can pass it with 50 votes. But when you have only 50 votes in the Senate, that isn't a simple matter. So we've been going through this very difficult process of figuring out what especially a few senators' bottom line is in terms of what will be in that bill. So the bottom line, as you said, or the top line is going to be reduced. But I think the really important question is what does that buy? That's the question we need to focus on. And the things you talked about, some kind of adjustment in the corporate tax rate, a conception of public education that goes K through 14, the other one you were mentioning was the prescription drug matter. Yep. Yes, that's important too. That's important as a matter of policy. It's important also as a revenue raiser to give Medicare the power to negotiate drug prices. Those things, as you said, have become controversial points in this. And I think you're quite accurate that a lot of the negotiation has focused on those things. Other things, I think that child tax credit will be in there in some form. I certainly hope Medicaid expansion and the reforms we have in the Affordable Care Act to make that more accessible to people. I think those things in some form will be in there, as well as enhanced child care, as well as enhanced pre-K education. There are lots of things that people overwhelmingly agree with, and in some form, I think they will be in the final bill.
So, Congressman Price, I think for many folks, particularly, recent watchers of D.C., we think of Democrats and Republicans negotiating against one another across the aisle, across these ideological differences. But as you pointed out, this is Democrats who are negotiating with other Democrats. What does this say about where the party is right now? Do you see this broad ideological spectrum as a strength of the party or as a potential challenge for it going forward?
I see it both ways. When now that I've announced my retirement, I am being asked to reflect on the differences I see in the party over the years. I think the growing diversity of the party is a strength. It's a political strength, and it's a strength in terms of reflecting accurately the makeup of our country. That diversity has included, however, some coming together ideologically. When I first came to the Congress, the memory wasn't too distant of the bad old days when, mainly Southern segregationist senators presided over committees endlessly. And that was division, and that was really a problem. And so there's been some coming together on the Democratic side over these years, although we have greater diversity in terms of ethnic diversity and so on. The challenge, of course, is to turn that diversity, make sure that diversity is a strength. It clearly is representative of America, but in the end of the day, we've got to come together. Not anybody in that whole spectrum is going to get their way totally. And the art of politics, I think, in this case, is to figure out, when have I pushed just as hard as I can from my point of view? When am I going to have to say, okay, some of this will have to wait for another day, but the important thing is for this institution to perform. And since we have no Republican help, for the Democratic Party to perform under the most difficult possible circumstances, 50 votes, this is what we all need to think about. This isn't just about us individually. This is about our country and what we need to produce for the country.
So, Congressman Price, you in the seat that you serve in, the district that you represent in Congress, has been redistricted multiple times during your career. In fact, I remember that you were actually not in office very briefly during the time I was in graduate school at Duke, and I had the great pleasure of sharing the department with you at that time. But I'm wondering, as you look at this question of redistricting in the state of North Carolina, as well as across the country, if you think Democrats have a truly fair shot of holding on to the majority in the House after the 2022 midterms?
Yes, I think we do, but it is a struggle. And I can't imagine an opposition party behaving more badly than our Republican colleagues are at this moment, allowing themselves to be basically co-opted by Donald Trump. And actually a majority of these guys voting not to certify a legitimate election. That's really basic Democratic, small D Democratic territory. Hard to believe that behavior would be rewarded. Yet we do have a situation with redistricting where in a lot of states, including our state, the Republicans are in charge and they show every intention of drawing maps that are grossly distorted in terms of giving Republicans advantage. So we all know this midterm election could be will be very close, and it could be determined by factors such as this that seemingly have very little to do with how the Republican Party has performed.
As you are stepping away, you said people have asked you to reflect on the party and on the workings of Congress. Can you also reflect a bit on your own career? Are there moments that for you you're particularly proud of, or some that you would change if you could?
Oh, my. Well, there's a lot of memories that come flooding back, including a lot I haven't thought of in years and I'm being reminded of. I guess I can answer in this way that, there's some moments of team victory. You know, the House is a lot of people, 435 people. It's much more controlled by party leadership than the Senate is. And because it has to be with that many people and that great diversity. So there are team victories, some of which I remember very, very fondly. The Affordable Care Act finally getting that done. I also remember some really tough things where we got hold of the budget in the Clinton years by one vote. And I had worked on that very hard. So those team victories stand out, and the achievements of those years when we had a Democratic president, a Democratic majority, the Obama Recovery Act, just so much that we achieved together. And those were lasting achievements. There are also individual moments. I guess my biggest single item is the Environmental Protection Agency lab, which you may remember there in the Research Triangle Park. We worked 9 years on that, 9 years to get the appropriations for what is now the preeminent environmental lab in the country. We've got wonderful train service, Raleigh to Charlotte. We're going to bring it on to Richmond and Washington. We've got a gleaming National Guard headquarters that I shook the money loose of the Recovery Act. So there are those individual memorials, I guess, to the kind of efforts that I and others were able to make.
You know, obviously you have no idea whether a Democrat or a Republican will win the 4th Congressional District or precisely what the district lines will even look like. But given how long you've served the people of that district, I'm wondering if you have advice for whomever will follow you in this office, a piece of advice, maybe less about Congress and more about the people themselves. What does the next representative of the 4th Congressional District need to know?
Well, it's a district that is of uncertain dimensions at this moment. Of course, we get drawn and redrawn all the time because of the way we get gerrymandered and the courts keep reversing these plans. But this is going to be very different because of population growth. And I hope will still be a district where someone of my political persuasion can do well. I lost one election. I lost an election, the Gingrich Revolution in 94. I learned some things from that in terms of being very appreciative of my own friends and supporters. I'll never forget the kind of urging I had to get back in the game. But I also, over the years, have learned that so much of what you do is independent of your ideology or even of your policy stance. Offer good service. People, you are the contact. The member of the U.S. House, believe it or not, even though it's 800,000 constituents, still, you are the most immediate contact most people locally have with the federal government. So that that carries with it a certain responsibility. You need to interpret what's going on, be a good listener, even though you can't always agree. And then offer people service who run into difficulties with their everything from their immigration status to their Social Security check. That is something people need. They remember, and it has nothing to do with your party label.
Congressman Price, thank you so much. You remind us that this is indeed meant to be the people's house. Representative David Price is a House member representing North Carolina's 4th Congressional District. Representative Price, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you.
As with every single piece of legislation that's inched its way through D.C. this year, it's the Senate that wields decisive power. And these days, it's two senators in particular. And I bet you can guess which ones. That's right, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Raphael Warnock of Georgia. No, just kidding. Making sure you're paying attention. No, of course, we're talking about Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. These two nominal Democrats are significant stumbling blocks on the road to realizing the president's Build Back Better vision. Now, sometimes it feels like Manchin and Sinema are just being stubborn for the sake of it. But you know what? Maybe there is method to what sometimes feels like madness. Here to pull back the curtain on the big influencers that you won't find on TikTok is Lee Drutman, senior fellow at New America and author of The Business of America is Lobbying. Welcome, Lee.
Great to be with you, Melissa.
So I'm just going to hypothesize here that part of what is going on with Manchin and Sinema is lobbying pressure. Is that a reasonable hypothesis or way off the map?
Oh, that's a great hypothesis, and there's some circumstantial evidence to your guess that both Manchin and Sinema have been taking a lot of money from some big industries with big stakes in this bill. Manchin has been getting a lot of money from some energy companies that are a little concerned about the whole green energy thing and what that means for their business. Sinema's been taking some money from the pharmaceutical companies who don't really love the idea of government being able to negotiate down prices for drugs. And you know, so their positions seem to reflect that. So, you know, maybe these industry lobbyists are spending a lot of time with them and convincing them why we should go slow on green energy or why we should let the pharmaceutical companies charge whatever they want.
All right. I want to take a listen to a little bit of that circumstantial evidence. This is Exxon's senior director of federal relations, Keith McCoy, and he was speaking in a video that was leaked about Joe Manchin. Let's listen.
Joe Manchin, I talk to his office every week. He is the kingmaker on this because he's a Democrat from West Virginia, which is a very conservative state. So he is, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate. So on the Democrat side, we look for the moderates on these issues. So it's the Manchins, it's the Sinemas, it's the Testers.
All right. So I can see why people might think that's a smoking gun, but it also just sounds like good lobbying strategy. If you have a business interest you're representing, go talk to the folks who you think you can move.
Yeah, well, that's most of what lobbying is. It's not, you know, trying to convince the Elizabeth Warrens and Raphael Warnocks to suddenly change their position. It's finding the folks who might be your allies already. Yeah. Manchin is from a coal state. He's never been a particular environmental advocate. So, work with the folks who are already likely to support your view and give them all the resources they need. Arm them with the arguments, arm them with the legislative language, give them the talking points, and show that you are their best friends by helping them to raise money.
So why is that a problem for democracy?
Well, I think the real problem is that not everybody has the ability to spend $10 million a quarter on lobbying. I don't have that kind of money to throw around. Maybe this radio broadcasting thing is more lucrative than I think it is.
Us public radio hosts, for sure, $10 million sitting around to get our interests addressed.
Right. Well, that there's the problem is that, you know, the corporations and industry groups throw around a ton of money, and they hire every lobbyist they can who might have any way of you know, getting at Manchin or Sinema or anyone else, and they surround them with arguments. They, you know, they shape the debate, and it's fundamentally it's a resource game. There's just not a ton of lobbyists on the public interest side, and there's a ton of lobbyists on the corporate interest side. So things get pulled in one particular direction often.
So it's Talk to me a bit about that, because I'm, you know, we were chatting a bit before we got started, and thinking about like graduate school, you know, lobbying class 101. It's this idea that, you know, in part, you're going to have this asymmetry of the capacity to collectively organize around interests for lobbying that's going to benefit corporations. It's going to benefit those with the most resources. But what the voters have is the vote, right? So, you know, I might not be able to get me and my friends together $10 million, but we might be able to get together 10,000 votes, right, by organizing in that way. So does that not just all balance out in the, you know, in the work of representative government?
Well, certainly it would be nice if it did. But there's a couple obstacles there. You know, one is that... given that, you know, we have just two parties and almost all voting is partisan, there's just not a lot of leverage that most voters have against the incumbents that they generally support, because most elections, most districts are lopsided for one party or the other. So, you know, there's really just not that many options for most voters who are, you know, again, mostly going to support Democrats or Republicans. So voters just don't have that much leverage in our voting system. And the second thing that makes it difficult is that, you know, most policymaking is somewhat opaque to a lot of voters, and that, you know, we read about a, you know, a big social spending bill and we get sort of the headline number, but, you know, we often don't really go deep in what's actually in that bill and who's supporting what, and, you know, what are the consequences of that. And a lot of this is, you know, done through regulatory agencies or in sort of very technical language that is, you know, generally the province of these very specialized in the know lobbyists. And it's also an issue where, frankly, a lot of staff are kind of above their heads. They're trying to get above their heads on that, and they don't have the level of expertise and the depth of knowledge to really push back against the lobbyists. And in many cases, it's the lobbyists who are writing the legislative language. In many cases, it's the lobbyists who are really shaping the way in which staffers and members understand the issues. And that's because it's the lobbyists who are everywhere, and it's the companies who are able to hire that expertise, many of which comes from people who used to serve in Congress and then decided that they wanted to make a little bit more money and not work all the time, although they do work hard, but not the way that staffers work hard. And that creates, you know, two additional problems, which is that voters don't really have a ton of leverage in a system in which most elections are not competitive and there's only two choices. And, you know, staffers have a challenge in really, you know, going toe to toe with lobbyists in terms of expertise and resources, even if they might want to do policy that's a little bit more broadly in what they think of as the public interest.
All right, I want you to go down two quick rabbit holes with me. The first is, you said lobbyists are often writing the language, actually writing the legislative language itself, for folks who haven't been working on the Hill in recent years and may not know exactly what that means. Can you help us understand what you mean? They're actually showing up with language already written and handing them to our elected officials?
Yes, they are. They are writing draft language that they hand to congressional offices. And, you know, I mean, writing legislation is complicated because you have to write stuff in a very legal way that works with the code. I mean, most staffers don't write legislative language themselves. There's an Office of Legislative Counsel that turns ideas into language that will work with the U.S. code. But the lobbyists are happy to provide that. Yeah, staffers and members are not policy experts. They depend on others for that expertise. And most lobbyists have someone, you know, who they work with or themselves who can draft that language for them. And that's very helpful to congressional offices because congressional offices don't have those internal resources.
All right, then the last thing here. How is this whole process, as you've been describing it, how is it likely impacting the reconciliation work on the Build Back Better plan that we've just been discussing on the show?
Well, this is boom time for the Washington lobbying industry. It's been one of the best quarters in a long time for lobbyists. And so do a major social spending bill, there's a lot of interests that have a stake in policy and are trying to shape it. So yeah, I mean, you look at any major bill, you look at the tax bill the Republicans put together a few years ago, that was a lobbying bonanza. You look at all the pandemic spending, that's a lobbying bonanza. And anywhere the government is doing big policy, you're going to find lobbyists and lobbying interests behind almost every provision.
Final. I realize I need one more, though. Is there a solution to this?
Well, the solution that I've proposed is for Congress to invest a lot more in its own expertise and its own capacity. Congress has fewer staff than it did 40 years ago, especially on the committees, which used to be the places where there was real expertise. People spent a long time really getting to know the issues. And you know, Congress doesn't pay its staffers enough. Work in the public sector is often just a stepping stone to lobbying. So if Congress is serious about fighting back against the influence of lobbyists, Congress should double or triple the money that it spends on its own staff. I mean, right now there's a lot more money that companies spend to hire lobbyists than Congress spends to pay staffers to develop policy expertise, particularly in the committees, that could really go toe-to-toe with a lot of the expertise that is in the private sector right now.
Ooh, Lee Drutman, that is a tough sell politically. I absolutely get the policy relevance of that, but yeah, we should spend more on ourselves. That is a rough one to pass at home. Lee Drutman is the senior fellow at New America and author of The Business of America is Lobbying. He's also got a new book out called Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
I have a few questions. First, how satisfied are you with the direction the country is headed? Do you support abolishing the filibuster in the Senate? Has your household financial situation gotten worse during the pandemic? These are just some of the questions asked in a recent survey of a random sample of Black adults in America. And the survey is part of the Black to the Future Action Fund. It's a temperature check series. And the responses point to the continuing burdens of the pandemic and growing dissatisfaction with the current policy environment. I spoke with Alicia Garza, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter Global Network and the head of the Black to the Future Action Fund.
One of the things that we know is that Black communities are often left out of the conversation, or our experiences and the things we want to see are dictated to us rather than listened to from us. And so what we decided to do earlier this year is to do a temperature check poll, where essentially we're taking a temp check every other month of what it is that Black communities want to see from their government, how we are experiencing the public policy that's shaping our lives, and what we want to see done about that public policy. So we have been working with our partners at Socioanalytica Research to really capture the Black experience and help shape the agenda that is coming out of the White House, and also the agendas that are coming out of our state legislatures. So through this poll, we're asking people to weigh in on the state of the country, the state of our leadership, policy priorities, and how issues like the COVID-19 pandemic and its health and economic consequences are impacting us. And we are trying to provide key insights on what we experience. what we want and what we need to become powerful. Yesterday, we released the results of the second survey of our poll that was taken in September, and the first one that we did was conducted in July.
So give me a couple of the top lines. What, in the broadest sense, have you found?
Well, one of the things that we found is that Black communities are going backwards as it relates to relief and recovery. And in particular, we've lost protections in two key areas. One is about stopping evictions, and the other is about expanding unemployment benefits. So our polls show that Black folks are feeling the brunt of government not working for us, even though we're working hard for it. And this incomplete and incorrect belief that the pandemic has subsided. So what we see here through our poll is that more than half of the people that we talk to are dissatisfied with the state of the economy. And that's a 17 percentage point increase since July. We've also found that a third of renters and mortgage holders are not confident that they're going to be able to make their payments on time. And nearly half have said that they're having difficulty paying for household expenses. We also found that dissatisfaction with the direction of the country and with the state of the economy has significantly increased. And the approvals of the president, governors, and Congress is also decreasing.
You're saying that since President Biden has been elected and inaugurated, since we've had what is presumably at least a numeric majority or a tie in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, that you're finding a reduction of satisfaction and a sense of sort of less sense of efficacy and optimism about the future among Black folk?
That's exactly what we're saying, and that's exactly what the poll shows. You know, when President Biden was elected, there was a lot of hopefulness about the direction of the country, particularly given what we were coming out of under the Trump administration. And so we saw high approval rates of the president and the vice president, and we also saw high approval rates in terms of Congress and governors. But over time, what we're seeing is that Black communities have significantly less confidence in the job that the president is doing, the jobs that governors are doing, and Congress, because we're seeing time after time, even though we showed up and showed out, our priorities are not staying on the table.
Is this primarily about the economic pieces that you had just cited, about the continuing struggles to just make ends meet?
We saw this when we did the Black Census in 2018, that the number one issue that Black communities cared about, the number one issue that was keeping us awake at night, were wages that were too low to support a family, followed by a lack of access to affordable and quality housing, and then, of course, followed by a lack of access to affordable and quality healthcare. And these are all economic issues. These are all safety and support issues. And when we were going into 2020, some of the things that Black folks were saying that we wanted to see was more economic security. We wanted to see government work for us. And so certainly there was a lot of hope that President Biden, particularly through the campaigning he was doing, was going to put the core issues that Black communities are facing on the table and get things done. And what we're finding is that Black communities are seeing that things are not getting done when it comes to relief and recovery from the pandemic. There's an assumption that it's over. And so even though we had that brief burst of stimulus, we're finding again that, you know, some of the most popular solutions that Black communities want to see is an ongoing stimulus to help make sure that we are able to come out of this pandemic fully recovered. And that's not happening. We're also seeing, right, that Black folks want to see bold action from Congress. You know, more than two-thirds of respondents to this poll said that they wanted to see the filibuster amended so that things could get done. And yet, as we're looking at what's happening with the infrastructure bill, right, we're seeing that it is that very tool that is in the way of relief and recovery for Black communities. So that's why I think we're starting to see that satisfaction is decreasing, because time and time again, we're seeing that the priorities of Black communities, with the economy being at the top, are not getting done and they're not getting dealt with.
Let's talk a little bit more about solutions as well. So you've talked about some of those economic solutions, for example, the continuing stimulus and support to ensure that Black communities can actually emerge from the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. What are some of those other economic solutions, but also some of the ones that you asked about and found out about around racism and white supremacy?
So look, what Black communities want is bold action. We want to see real solutions for real people. We don't want our government to be organized around a boogeyman that never seems to come out of the shadows. What we actually need right now is bold and creative solutions that are going to give our communities relief and push our communities ahead. And so what we are doing is we're saying to the Biden-Harris administration, we are saying to Congress, go bold or go home. And that is a dire warning for the midterm elections coming up in just a couple of months. Congress has the opportunity to pass bold legislation, but we have to use the power that Black voters provided. What we want to see is to pass this $3.5 trillion Build Back Better Act before passing the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. You know, earlier this year, we released our Build Back Bolder mandate as a policy roadmap for elected leaders who committed to advancing racial equity, and we collected more than 50,000 endorsements for this mandate. Among some of these demands include expanding the child tax credit payment and making it permanent, making substantial investments into affordable housing, passing comprehensive legislation to pass and expand voting rights because democracy is crumbling before our eyes. We need to see the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act moved through Congress if we want to have fair elections in 2022. We also think that what we want to see here is to challenge the policies and practices that leave us sick and dying younger and deliver the care that we need to live long and live well. One of the big things that came up in the poll was this conversation about white supremacy and white nationalism. We know that there's been a commission that's been convened, but we need to see bold action there. We need to make sure that there are consequences when actions are taken that threaten the health and well-being of our communities. And so what we need to do there is to see a rejection of the toxic culture of white nationalism by addressing it in every opportunity and in front of every audience.
Alicia Garza is co-founder of the Black Lives Matter Global Network and the head of the Black to the Future Action Fund. Thank you for joining us, Alicia.
Thanks so much for having us.
Unions. We're talking here, AFL-CIO, SEIU, American Federation of Teachers. You know what I'm talking about. Unions pulled out all the stops to get President Joe Biden elected in 2020. And so far, President Biden has given them love right back. Here he is last month honoring unions on Labor Day.
On Labor Day, we honor the dignity of the American worker. And every day, we remember that America wasn't built by Wall Street. They're not all bad folks on Wall Street. I'm not suggesting that. But they didn't build America. It was built by the middle class. And unions built the middle class.
Well, labor is having a moment right now.
Hold that line.
UAW-74! We're willing to stay out here one day longer, one day stronger, however long to take, but we are willing to negotiate with the company whenever they're ready to talk.
In October, workers at John Deere, Kellogg, and Kaiser Permanente have all gone on strike. And according to Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, there have been close to 180 labor strikes so far this year. Here's what Chris Larson, an employee at John Deere for 19 years, told Democracy Now! About why they are striking.
What we're asking for is a fair shake and something equitable. I'd like to quote Walter Reuther here. We don't want a bigger slice of pie, we want a bigger pie.
For more on this, I spoke with Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times labor reporter and author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor.
We're seeing lots of turbulence, tumult right now. We're seeing a series of strikes, a big wave of strikes. Over 10,000 workers have walked out at 14 John Deere factories. We're seeing a strike at Kellogg's in four different states. 1,400 workers have walked out. There's a long-running coal strike in Alabama. Nurses walked out at a hospital in Buffalo. There's a very long strike at a hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts. And then 24,000 nurses for Kaiser Permanente have voted to authorize a strike if they don't get what they want in negotiations. So there's a lot going on in labor, and I think a lot of workers are fed up. They feel they worked extremely hard. They gave their all during the pandemic, and then their employers come back and offer them mediocre to lousy contract offers. And they say, what's going on? We gave, we did our all, we increased your profits, and why are you offering us such a measly deal? That's on the union side, Melissa. On the non-union side, you know, we're just seeing a lot of workers exasperated, frustrated, fed up. As one economist described it, it's a take this job and shove it economy. They say, we risk our lives during the pandemic while you well-paid white-collar workers worked at home. We blue-collar workers, we frontline workers, busted our derrieres, busted our humps, risk getting COVID. And now you're just offering us measly raises and still forcing us to work tons of overtime. And we're going to look for better jobs, better paying jobs elsewhere. So that's why there's been this so-called great resignation. I might call it the great exodus from jobs. You know, more people are voluntarily quitting their jobs than any time in the last two decades. And that's because many people have reassessed their jobs during the pandemic, reassessed their lives and their work life, work family balance, and say, something's broken. I want something better. And I'm not just ready to walk, but I'm walking to look for a better job.
Let's start with non-unionized workers, where we're seeing, you know, if you're looking at the data, right? So if you've got this sort of 10,000 foot perspective, you can see all of these individual workers in individual households in different cities and communities, right, making this choice to exit and to find other kinds of work. Now, is that just happening sort of individual by individual? Or is there actually, even for those who are not unionized, is there a collective conversation happening somewhere? Or is it really just like a trend that we're seeing? I'm trying to understand what those data tell us about how workers are making that decision. And then we'll come to the unions themselves.
I saw that Lane Wyndham, a labor expert at Georgetown, called it a general strike by non-union workers. I think that's an overstatement, but I think a lot of non-union workers read that other non-union workers are really dissatisfied and they're walking, they're voluntary quitting, they're exiting. And they're saying, maybe I shouldn't put up with this $9 or $10 an hour fast food job when I could get a job at Amazon for $15. People, you know, have opened their eyes. I think the pandemic has forced a lot of people to really open their eyes and see, hey, I'm not really being treated well at work. You know, I'm getting paid only $10 an hour. Some weeks they only have me working 12 hours. Other weeks they force me to work 10 hours overtime involuntarily. And after several decades in which things in many ways have gotten worse and worse for American workers, stagnant wages, health benefits have gotten worse, retirement benefits have gotten worse. And now that the pandemic is receding and now that many employers are reopening and are desperate to hire people, workers say, we have an opportunity, we have more power than before. And I think non-union workers, it's kind of contagious. They see this happening. They see reports on TV, on radio, and say, I could exercise more power. I could leave my job. I could tell my boss, if you don't give me a $3 an hour raise, I'm going to leave my job. And a big question now is whether this will lead to a more long-term improvement in wages and how workers are treated.
In this mass exodus, are we also seeing mass organizing? I'm wondering for non-union workers, if we're seeing a move towards unionization, towards other kinds of collective bargaining, so that some of it doesn't have to be simply an exodus, but could actually be about a shift of cultures, of practices, and of pay.
Melissa, thanks for clarifying this point. Many workers are happy, especially white-collar workers who could work at home safely, away from COVID, you know, not having to commute two hours a day. But it's the frontline workers, the essential workers, the blue-collar workers, the fast food workers, the factory workers, the meatpacking workers. They're much more disgruntled. They're much more fed up. They're much more ready to leave. Is this translating into more organizing? In the biggest unionization victory of the year, 3,000 professors at the University of Pittsburgh have voted to unionize, 71% to 29%. That's a big victory for labor. I'm sure many of your listeners have read about the effort to unionize Starbucks in Buffalo. That's the most sophisticated effort to unionize a Starbucks in the country. There are nearly 6,000 Starbucks in the nation right now, not a single corporate-owned Starbucks in the nation, not a single one is unionized.
Okay, so now let's talk about workers who are unionized in this moment and who are striking, not just in a general strike way, but who are making that choice to strike. What's going on and how are those companies responding?
So I work in a story about this, and I interviewed a striker at John Deere. I interviewed a striker at Kellogg, and they both used the exact same phrase. I asked them, how do you feel about the company's offer? And they both said, it's a slap in the face. And at both Kellogg's and at John Deere, workers worked a lot of overtime during the pandemic because there was great demand for their products. Meanwhile, profits at those companies are way up. The CEOs are paying themselves, $15 million, $20 million a year. And the workers at Deere, the workers at Kellogg, you know, see that there's a labor shortage now. They see the companies are desperate to hire. They realize, hey, if we walk out, it's not going to be easy for the company to find replacement workers to weaken our strike. And I think both Kellogg and Deere kind of, they didn't get the memo that, hey, the world has changed. Hey, you know, millions of American workers, you know, busted their hump, worked very hard, gave their all, risked their lives during the pandemic. And it's time for employers to treat their workers better. And a lot of employers are treating their workers better and are giving raises. And they're not the ones facing strikes. At Deere, at Kellogg, they're both insisting on two-tier contracts. And a lot of these workers are saying, you know, what about the future of our children? If there's a two-tier contract, our children are going to end up with a much worse wages, much worse working conditions than we have. So they're fighting, you know, these workers at Deere and at Kellogg are fighting to maintain standards. They don't want wages and working conditions going backwards, especially after they worked so hard during the pandemic and after they've been called, quote, essential, unquote, workers.
So you've been talking about this pandemic moment as a turning point for so much in how both American workers understand themselves as essential, understand where they connect. Are there any historical parallels? Are there moments in our history where similarly there seemed to be this sort of great awakening of laborers understanding, hey, wait a minute, we may have a lot more power in this system than it initially seems?
Great question. So historians will point out that 1919, the year after the First World War, and 1946, the year after the Second World War ended, had the biggest strike waves in American history. It was the great reassessment, the great rethinking of my jobs after having served in a war, and is this what I want, and can't I do better? And there is kind of this great reassessment going on now. We've been through this, you know, hellish year, this hellish 18 months, where a lot of workers, you know, worked at home. They saw their job, their lives on the line when they were working in supermarkets or at fast food places or in meatpacking plants or in factories. And it's made them rethink, you know, is it worth my doing this? Is it worth working 70 hours and hardly seeing my kids during the week? Is it worth working for $10, $11 an hour? So I think this big historical, ugly historical development, the pandemic, is making people rethink, you know, their jobs, whether they like their jobs enough, whether they think their jobs are so bad that they should look elsewhere, whether the life-family balance in their jobs is so bad that it's time to look elsewhere.
All right. I want to talk about the politics of this a little bit. So when you look at the Democratic Party, union households remain among the most staunch supporters and most likely voters for the Democratic Party. And unions remain a really great way to just sort of organize the vote, right? It's basically black churches and union meetings if you want to get out that Democratic Party vote. So what are we going to see, or what do you suspect we might see from, or are already seeing, not only from DC lawmakers, but I'm thinking here specifically of Democrats in states and maybe Democrats in states where you don't have a lot of union activity, but now suddenly there's this kind of labor boiling. Is it possible for lawmakers to either shut this all down or really expand this in ways that allow for workers to really move forward politically as well as economically?
Joe Biden is the most pro-union president since FDR. Some people say even more pro-union. He's made extremely pro-union statements, more than anything FDR said, where, you know, he kind of backed the unionization effort at Amazon. He talks about the importance of more workers unionizing to create a fairer economy and to lift workers. But he's reluctant to put his thumb on the scale during a strike. He said the strike at Deere it's a righteous strike, but he's not ready to say, I support the workers in this strike. But I think workers do feel emboldened because there is this pro-union president. And Biden, much more than Barack Obama, much more than Bill Clinton, much more than Jimmy Carter, sees that having strong unions is important, one, to create a fair economy, two, to help lift workers' wages and reduce wage stagnation. And third, for political reasons, stronger unions are important to help the Democrats for fairness, for the good of the economy, and for politics, and for protecting our democracy to help unions grow. I think that's why Biden, you know, is trying very hard to help unions and help blue collar workers. His efforts to make childcare more affordable, his push to make community college free. You know, a lot of blue collar workers can hardly afford to send their kids to college, even community college. So Biden had this great idea to make community college free. I worry that's going to be deleted from his plan. You know, the $300 a month childcare tax credit, that's to help blue collar families. It might not mean much for people earning $500,000 a year, but it'll mean a lot for blue collar families, frontline workers who make $50,000 or $30,000 a year. And Biden's infrastructure plan, that's to create hundreds of thousands of good middle class, and Biden always says union jobs, because he wants to strengthen the working class, strengthen blue collar America. And I'm sure he has in mind, if I do all those things, I'll make a lot of workers in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Minnesota and Iowa and Ohio happy. And that's not just good for society and good for our economy, but it will help the Democrats politically.
Stephen Greenhouse is a former New York Times labor reporter and the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thanks so much.
Okay, that's all the politics we have for y'all today. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Now, before I take off, I want to give a huge shout out to the team who helps make this show happen every week. Our senior producer is Ethan Oberman. Our producers are Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, Deborah Goldstein, and Joseph Gedeon. Shanta Covington is now our planning editor. Whoop, whoop! Zachary Bynum is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jay Cowan is our director, and they both double up as the show's sound designers. And we had help this week from WNYC's Jason Isaac on the board as well. Special shout out to the Wednesday Deep Dive crew. My co-host in that series is Dorian Warren. And the Deep Dive theme music is by my man, James Perry. Thanks, James. Jackie Martin is our line producer, and David Gable is our executive assistant. And welcome to Mary Croak, our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, your new permanent host and managing editor. And this remains The Takeaway.